This is Seattle's Morning News. Everybody loves the orcas now that they're in danger of disappearing. But it turns out it wasn't always that way. And so we have consulted an orca historian, Jason Colby, who's actually an environmental historian at the University of Victoria and has written a book about this. So you're telling me at one point the orcas were feared and vilified?
Absolutely. This was an animal that was considered not just a pest that ate valuable salmon and fur seals, but rumor had it attacked people. And it was extremely common in Puget Sound and the rest of the Northwest for fishermen to take shots at them. This was really considered a vermin species and a dangerous one at that.
So what changed that?
Well, it really changed right here in the Northwest. And in fact, you know, the most pivotal event took place right on the Seattle waterfront. In the summer of 1965, a local entrepreneur who owned the first real major Seattle aquarium, doesn't exist anymore, entrepreneur named Ted Griffin, bought an orca, a large male orca who had accidentally been caught by Canadian fishermen in northern BC, built a floating pen and brought this whale named Namu all the way south hundreds of miles onto the Seattle waterfront and became the very first whale to be in shows, choreographed shows eventually with Griffin himself. Griffin became the first human being that we know to swim with a killer whale.
Wow. This was before SeaWorld?
It is. In fact, SeaWorld received their very first killer whale from Griffin after Namu became so famous. And in fact, Namu was written up in National Geographic. Headlines appeared all over the world about this surprisingly friendly killer whale on the waterfront of Seattle. And SeaWorld, which was brand new at the time in San Diego, actually bought another whale that Griffin captured in Puget Sound. And that whale, initially, they wanted to name that whale Namu as well because that name was so famous, and Griffin refused. And so they opted for She Namu, which became Shamu.
Shamu. So what is the importance of orcas now to the Pacific Northwest? Besides just, you know, they're amazing animals, they have spawned an industry, haven't they?
They have. I mean, the governor's office in its report notes that the whale watching industry brings in, you know, some $60 million into Washington State alone, and actually probably more in BC. But I would push it beyond the financial value and talk about what this population, this endangered population of orcas, really means to people in the Northwest. I mean, they've become the icon of our region, surpassing even salmon. And it's hard for us to imagine this place without them. They've become a part of the fabric of our culture, the way we understand our interaction with the marine ecosystem. And I would also say that they've given a tremendous amount to us unknowingly in helping us rethink the way we interact with wildlife. I mean, they really were transformative for us on the Pacific coast. And so, you know, we need to ask ourselves if we have a moral obligation to them to make sure that they survive.
Well, of course, they feed on salmon. They don't just feed on salmon, though, right? Don't they eat seals?
Well, there are different ecotypes, and the you know, an ecotype that specializes in hunting marine mammals in our area, especially seals and sea lions, is actually doing well and growing. Those are called the transients or Biggs killer whales. Mm-hmm. The endangered population, the southern resident killer whales, who really range from northern California to southern BC, but it spent a lot of time in Puget Sound, they feed almost exclusively on salmon and beyond that, overwhelmingly on Chinook salmon, which are the largest but also the rarest in our waters.
Now, biologically, could they be taught to adjust? I mean, it'd be great if they take away some of the seals, because I know that the fishermen would appreciate that. But or are they so specialized in the way they've adapted that they can only eat one type of salmon?
This seems to be, I mean, they do feed on other types of salmon kind of selectively when the need presents itself, it seems. But the flip side of orcas as extraordinarily efficient social predators is that, you know, a lot of the characteristics that make them so efficient in targeting particular species, in this case, Chinook salmon, make them really reluctant to adapt and to change. And, you know, part of this culture that they have, really, this food culture, is an important part of their matrilineal structure. The fact that they have, you know, mothers and grandmothers leading these pods, their knowledge of these Chinook runs probably shapes their migrations and where they look for food. And the frightening thing, I think, for us and probably for them is that the knowledge that had led them to quite a bit of success now seems to be leading them down a dead end, potentially, towards starvation.
So explain to me how this works. You said they've developed a culture. So there's essentially a style of hunting that is especially suited to Chinook salmon?
Yeah, there's ongoing debates among scientists about whether, you know, animals and certainly whales have what we would call culture. But probably the best argument for this is killer whales, is orcas themselves who have what we might call, you know, specialized dialects among their pods that help distinguish particular populations and even within their mate lines, particular calls that almost act like ethnic distinctions for them. They also have within these families and mate lines their own particular behaviors that are unique to them and their migrations that are passed along, not genetically, but from generation to generation, which is really, you know, the definition of culture. And so part of what we stand to lose here is not just this culturally and historically significant population of killer whales, but a rich and unique whale culture that doesn't really have a comparable anywhere else.
Jason Colby is an environmental historian at the University of Victoria. Jason, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Jason also is the author of Orca, How We Came to Know and Love the Ocean's Greatest Predator. Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. The Nobel Prize has been awarded to two researchers who have discovered a new class of cancer drugs. So to find out more, let's go to somebody who has actually attended a Nobel Prize ceremony.
Major Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. This prize went to James P. Allison of the U.S. and Tetsuko Hanjo of Japan for using the body's own immune system to fight cancer. I thought we had been doing that all along.
Yeah, good morning, Dave. It's a great question. It's actually an area of medicine and research that has been tried and has been only semi-successful. But these two researchers have found one of the most successful pathways for actually using the body's immune system to attack cancer cells, whereas many other attempts have failed. So the Nobel Prize was awarded to them. And I think we should make mention of what the Nobel Prize is, because it actually is one of the most prestigious awards given in the world. And the Nobel Prize itself is a set of six annual international awards that are given in several different categories by Swedish and Norwegian institutions for their recognition of academic, cultural, or scientific advances. But in medicine, in science, the Nobel Prize in physiology or medicine is clearly the most prestigious award that's been offered in the world. I actually had the privilege of attending the Nobel Prize ceremony in 1998, 2 years after I finished my PhD in pharmacology, when my PhD advisor, Dr. Luis Ignaro, won the Nobel Prize in physiology and medicine.
What did he invent?
Well, he didn't actually invent anything. He discovered a mechanism that how the cells that line the blood vessels actually regulate how blood vessels dilate and constrict. And actually, interestingly enough, that same mechanism and that same substance that he identified is actually involved in the development of drugs like Viagra and Cialis and so forth for the treatment of erectile dysfunction. So it actually, his discoveries led to another whole class of drugs for the treatment of a whole bunch of different medical disorders.
So the blood vessels are not just passive pipes.
They're not just passive pipes. They're actually a dynamic, and they respond to changes in pressure and stress and the environment.
And so to this current Nobel Prize for immunotherapy and cancer, what is the promise of this? How would this change the treatment of cancer?
What these guys did was they tried to harness the energy of the immune system, the body's own system, to fight and attack tumor cells. And as I said earlier, it's something that has been thought about for years, but nobody's really successfully done it. But they noticed that there are certain proteins that can put a brake on the immune systems, so they can actually stop the immune system from recognizing the cancer cells. These chemicals inside the body are called checkpoints, and they actually inhibit the cells, which are called T cells, from fighting the cancer cells. And so they've developed a class of drugs called checkpoint inhibitors. And the way this kind of works is the T cell, we have T cells, which are a certain kind of cell in our bloodstream. They're white blood cells, and they can actually identify and kill cells that are infected or damaged or cancerous. But in order for the T cell to work, it has to be activated. And so these activated T cells can find and attack cancer cells. And when that happens, they then seek out and they seek and destroy, so to speak. But the problem is that these cancer cells have a way of evading the T cells by creating these checkpoints. And when they create these checkpoints, the T cells no longer see the cancer cells, and the cancer cells are designed to survive, and so they can grow unchecked.
So they create kind of a camouflage then.
It is, actually.
And so they figured a way past this camouflage?
Right. Well, I mean, cancer cells have evolved to survive. So that's why cancer is difficult to treat, because it wants to survive. And so these malignant cells grow and grow and grow. And the way they do it is by evading the body's immune system. Because otherwise, these activated T cells would attack the cancer cells and kill them. But the thing is they have these checkpoint chemicals that essentially hide themselves, the cancer cells, from the T cells, and then they grow without being in check. So anyway, these guys developed a class of drugs called checkpoint inhibitors, and these checkpoint inhibitors can physically block the checkpoints on the cancer cell, and that then frees the immune system to attack the cancer. And so a single activated T cell can kill thousands of cancer cells, and our body is loaded with T cells. So these are really effective drugs in the appropriate setting for attacking cancer cells. And there's all kinds of stories and studies that have shown that when these checkpoint inhibitors are used for the appropriate type of cancers, that people can be cured for 10 years.
So this is the magic bullet everybody's looking for.
Well, it's a step towards the magic bullet. I don't think we have the magic bullet yet. This is not the cure to cancer. I want to be clear about that. This is not the cure to cancer. But this is a class of drugs that is very, very effective against certain types of cancers and has had very good results for people who have cancers that are susceptible to it.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
A second teenager has now been charged as an adult in the suspected gang war shooting that claimed the life of a grandmother sitting at her desk in Burien last month when the stray bullet hit her. At the same time, the King County Sheriff is pushing for more money for regional gang task force, and Hannah Scott is here with what we know now. Hannah?
Dave, a total of 3 Highline High School students, all described as known gang members, have now been arrested in connection with the drive-by shooting last month that claimed the life of 51-year-old Gabriela Reyes Dominguez. The 17-year-old suspected driver was charged with second-degree murder as an adult last month. While a second 17-year-old with a pending domestic violence case has been held in that case, he was originally thought to be the shooter but was never charged. And this all now worked itself out over the weekend. A third 17-year-old had been suspected of hiding the gun, and he was originally charged with illegal possession of a firearm. But investigators said Friday he was the shooter, and they have now charged him as an adult with second-degree murder. Now, that kid has twice been convicted of illegal possession of a firearm. He'd been through diversion for taking a gun to school a couple of years back, and he had just been released in March from juvenile detention, so he was on probation at the time of this shooting. All 3 of these kids are said to be members of the same gang, locked in a gang war with a rival gang in South King County, where King County Sheriff Mitzi Johankin has made a top priority.
This horrible gang war that we have going on, and we have to find a way to come together within law enforcement to not only proactively work to end that violence, but to provide services that will keep the youth that I'm seeing out of the gang life and carrying weapons and harming innocent bystanders.
As she laid out her budget priorities for the county council last week, the sheriff had good news about efforts to build up a regional gang task force.
I'd like you to know that I've already received cooperation and commitment from more than one, but a major city player in King County who's going to join with us already.
So more police agencies in the county have committed to joining with the sheriff's office to form a regional gang task force. The sheriff's hopes will eventually include 20 cops from multiple agencies. The King County executive's proposed budget included money for 2 of the 3 gang unit positions the sheriff had asked for to lead the gang unit. But the sheriff told the county council she needs all 3 of those.
A detective that can work on not only the guns that we recover, but the casings that we recover from crime scenes, and we found that guns move between the players in not only gangs but in crimes of violence, and so those guns are shared, and we need to track and figure out what crimes are being used in, and so we can more effectively find who's involved in this activity, and so we can solve homicides related to them.
And we don't know anything about the parents, whether the parents allowed the guns or knew what the kids were up to.
So that she says, as much as this is about taking on the enforcement level, which they will, you know, if it's a parent who has illegally a gun in their house, there's mm-hmm. a slew of other laws that they could be charged with that. A lot of these times, though, I think these kids and gangs are getting these guns out on the street, is what she's saying. They're just kind of out there. They're shared among gang members who are keeping them stashed or buying them illegally or something to that effect. But she does want to get involved with the families when we're talking about prevention.
Reach out to families and to find resources that might be available so we can connect with the families of youth involved in gangs and the schools. And so we've already are in conversation with our school resource officers down the Highline School District.
So there's a lot going on here behind the scenes. Again, like she just said, working with Highline School District is where all three of these kids went.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned that they'd already been through a diversion program, which is designed to keep them out of juvenile detention. And that's where the social workers are brought in.
Yes.
But that didn't work in this case.
That did not work in this case. And now that teenager is charged as an adult and will face serious time if convicted. He's charged with second-degree murder, as is the suspected driver.
It's
going
to lead people to ask if, instead of the diversion program, he had simply been locked up, this might not have happened.
And when I spoke to the Casey prosecutor's office a week or so ago, they led me to believe that that's not something they do in gang cases when they're 16 or older anymore. Given his age, I think he might have been 15 at the time, and that was for possession, illegal possession of a handgun. There was no violence involved. He just had the gun. So I think once you get to a violent thing, that they don't do any kind of diversion for that anymore.
And in terms of what prompted the shooting, this was just somebody walking down the street and feeling disrespected and then decides to open fire and then hits an innocent person sitting at her desk.
So what happened here is a gentleman, a 39-year-old man who's from the rival gang locked in this war, was picking up his own 15-year-old from Highline High School. They were walking around. These kids in this vehicle that are suspected of this drive-by were driving by. Something happened, was said that dad flashed his own gang signs.
Dad flashed his own gang signs.
Yes, and that led to, according to these charging documents, the shooter here to just spray 11 bullets in this drive-by, one of them hitting Gabriela Reyes Dominguez as she sat at her office in the chiropractor's office.
Hmm. Was it a good idea for dad to be flashing gang signs?
I mean, in my opinion.
The age of 39.
That's what we're dealing with here. And I believe I've been told his son, the 15-year-old, is a good student and not involved in gangs. It's the dad that was.
Hmm. All right. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Kyrita's Hannah Scott. Time for Sports Insider Danny O'Neill, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Not just Sports Insider, but Sports Psychic, because you got half the score right. You got the outcome right. You said 33-23. It was 33. A little better than 23.
Yeah, a lot better than 23.
You knew something that we didn't.
No, that's not true. That's not true, because it went down to the wire, and the Seahawks, who hadn't scored more than 30 points in any of their past 10 regular season games. They had 31 at the end of the third quarter. They just couldn't get the three more points they needed.
You saw a lot to like?
Yeah, I did. I was encouraged by the way they played. I think that there are some flaws and some faults. I think we'll look back on that as a game that was a stepping stone for this team.
Well, what I noticed listening to it while fixing a garage door was that there was a lot more running going on that seemed to confuse the Rams.
The Seahawks were able to control the line of scrimmage, and that was a huge deal against that team, because if you allow that defensive line to pin their ears back, Dave, which we know means that they're going to come after the passer, that they know that they're going to throw, that's going to be a terrible situation for Russell Wilson. Seattle was able to effectively run the ball, and it was a great recipe. And they mixed that in with some great long passes. That offense will hunt. Mm-hmm. If they play like that the rest of the season, I think they're going to the playoffs.
But then, I mean, the Rams would come right back. That's the other thing that was astounding. You know, suddenly they're 40 yards down the field.
And that's the part of it where I think we all knew that this defense was going to be a bit of a work in progress, that they're going to have to get better over the course of the season. And that's one of the things to look at, is specifically that they didn't tackle particularly well. Although it wasn't as atrocious as some people think, and they got victimized by a couple of concepts in the Rams' passing game in terms of crossing patterns, deep crossers that are a weak spot on
the
type of
defense. What was the sweep pattern that Rabel kept?
The fly sweep.
The fly sweep, yes. What was that? I have not heard that.
The fly sweep is where a wide receiver comes in motion at the snap, and he's essentially running laterally toward the sideline, right behind the quarterback at the moment the ball is snapped. What it does is it creates a decision for the defense. you have to account for that player as a runner. You have to have somebody who is ready to stop him, who is at a full sprint toward the sideline, from getting around the corner. And one of the biggest plays in the game, the Seahawks did. Robert Woods took the ball and went 57 yards, I think the run was, and it set up one of their touchdowns. And it's an extremely... It forces a decision by the defense. You have to account for that player because there's still a running back in the formation, and he can take the ball and run directly up. You can also throw out of it. So it's essentially forcing a decision. It's forcing the defense to account for multiple options on that play.
Okay, also, one thing I hadn't heard before, there was a whistle because the refs weren't in place?
Yeah.
What was that about?
Usually a referee will stand over the ball to keep the offense from starting it until everybody's set. I'm not sure why he wasn't in place yet, but there was an official that wasn't in place, and the Seahawks were lining up ready to snap it, so they blow it dead because the officials need to be in place.
Oh, I see. But nobody gets penalized for that.
Nobody gets penalized. Okay.
Go over the timeout controversy here.
People are furious about the Seahawks using a timeout, believing that the Rams would have punted the ball.
This is at the end of the game now.
Correct. There's 1:39 left. The Seahawks have just stopped the Rams on third down. Todd Gurley stopped short of the line, and the Seahawks have a decision. With 1:39 left, the refs are either going to start the game clock, at which point the Rams will have 33 seconds to run off, or use their final timeout to stop the clock. They use their final timeout, which is the right decision. You always make that decision as a coach. You don't let them sit and run off what at that point would have been one-third of the time that's left on the clock. After calling the timeout, the Rams send their offense out there. Quick snap, a quarterback sneak, get the first down, game is over. People go nuts because they observe the outcome, which is terrible, right?
Yeah.
The quarterback sneak that sinks the Seahawks' chances. And they start working backwards. Well, if they hadn't used the timeout, the Rams would have punted. Maybe. And maybe the Rams would have used 15 seconds off the play clock, then sent their offense out, and then the Seahawks call timeout, and then they run the quarterback sneak. Or maybe there's an alternate universe that we can open the door to. Honestly, as a coach, you're sitting there. The decision you have is with 1:39 left, do you let them wind the clock and run off 33 seconds, and you're getting the ball back with one timeout but a minute remaining, or do you call the timeout and stop the clock? You call the timeout and stop the clock. That's how you manage the clock.
Yeah.
So there's everybody
no question about that.
Everybody that's mad, get on Twitter and I'll fight you.
Let's see. I was going to ask you about the Oregon Ducks and whether it's fair that they get a week off before the big matchup with Washington.
Fair? No, not fair. All not right. fair at all.
We'll talk
no.
about that tomorrow.
No, not fair.
And we got to talk about the UFC match, too, because I'm a big fan. The Riot, yeah.
But only because I can pronounce Khabib Nurmagomedov.
Almost.
Nurmagomedov.
It was so bad, the governor of Nevada was seen running away from the arena.
Yeah, one of the combatants jumped out of the ring and started fighting people. Like, that's when you know that the situation is a little out of hand, where the arena for that designated for combat, one guy leaves it to fight someone, and another one of his friends jumps in to sucker punch the guy he just choked out.
That's a fight, right?
But
UFC, it's unlimited.
Yeah,
right?
No, there are rules.
Oh,
there are rules. Yeah, it was fairly awful.
Surprised me. Our Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Thank you, Danny.
You bet.
Latest numbers on unemployment are pretty stellar. In fact, we are at the lowest jobless rate since 1969. And every Monday, we call up CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger to put these numbers in perspective for us.
You know, when you think about 1969, you've got to go back and say what was going on in the economy. Number one, there was a war raging in Vietnam, and we had thousands of people who would be laborers who were out of the labor force at that time. And we didn't even have the huge rush and deluge of women into the labor force. And so that's one of the reasons that the unemployment rate was so low back in 1969. And now it's the exact same level in 2018. And we have a much larger labor force. So that does tell you that the market continues to improve. The economy is expanding. And we got pretty decent numbers. You know, it wasn't a huge job creation number up front, but 208,000 jobs a month on average in 2018. We're at the 10th year of an expansion. That is solid growth.
And Amazon's eruption of generosity, just deciding we're gonna pay $15 an hour. That is such a nice thing to do. Was there any economic necessity behind that?
I think so. I mean, first of all, I mean, there was all this chatter about, well, you know, oh, this was in response to Bernie Sanders. I just don't think so. I think it's harder to get entry-level workers. And this was a smart move ahead of the holiday season to say, we're going to pay not only the, you know, couple hundred thousand people who work for us already $15 an hour in these entry-level positions, but any temporary workers who come in. So this is really becoming interesting because there are absolute shortages of entry-level positions in lots of different industries. And I think that that is essentially what Amazon was reacting to.
So does this entitle us to get judgmental? In other words, can you truthfully say that if you don't have a job, by golly, you're just not trying?
No, because, you know, first of all, every situation is different. And I'll tell you what I have learned in, you know, hosting a radio show and having people call in all the time is that you hear people's stories, and I think a narrative is forming, and that is that it is pretty easy to get, not easy, but, you know, fairly easy to get an entry-level job. You may not like that job, okay? Mm-hmm. So right. That's clear. But there are a lot of entry-level jobs out there. Now, you may be able to get a very good higher wage job. You're a software developer, you're going to get a job. If you're a registered nurse, you are going to get a job. But what we are learning is that middle wage jobs are tougher. Those are not growing as much. And those are the kinds of jobs that include customer service representatives or a medical assistant, even construction laborers. So the middle wage, I think, are the jobs that you start hearing more and more about. Or you hear from middle wage earners who say, you know, when I was working for an auto company, you know, 20 years ago, I was really earning more relative to my cost of living or relative to the cost of living. That's what I start to hear a lot more of, that the nuance in some of these numbers.
For the stock market nerds, I have been reading some hand-wringing over how the slow creep in interest rates might entice people to pull money out of the stock market and that, you know, that's suddenly all these gains are going to disappear. What do you think about that?
Well, I don't think it's anything as sudden. I think that if you're an investor, you have to ask yourself a question every day, and that is, what is the risk that I'm taking, and what are my alternatives? When bond yields were really, really low after the financial crisis and even during the recovery, it was seemingly impossible to get any sort of reasonable rate of return without investing in risky assets like stocks. And in fact, we have an acronym to describe it. There are folks who said this is the TINA environment, meaning there is no alternative except the stock market. Now, last week, yield on a 10-year Treasury rose to 3.23%. It's the highest since 2011. And those yields start to look a little bit more interesting if you're sitting on big gains in the stock market, pretty long in the tooth bull market, and you say, huh, you know what? Maybe the risk of owning stocks going forward, yeah, I could make more money, but I have the security of locking those gains in and getting a nearly 3.25% return. So you are going to hear more about the bond market. For everyone, when you're looking at your 401k statement and you see that the Treasury market is changing or the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates, you look at your bond positions and you're going to get freaked out. You're going to say, oh my God, I'm losing money. Try to take a deep breath. We know that your stock positions are making money. Don't bail out of all of your bonds and go into stocks. That would be the wrong move right now.
CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Michelle LeClaire followed her mother's lead and joined the Church of Scientology as a young woman. She credited the church's principles with helping her to succeed as a businesswoman, became quite rich, a multimillionaire, donated millions to the church, in fact. But it all turned sour when her marriage began falling apart, and when the church would not consent to her wish to divorce her abusive husband, and because she came out as a lesbian. Here's her story.
Well, the Church of Scientology was started out with Dianetics. That's what L. Ron Hubbard wrote in the 50s. And he believed that there were two sides to the mind, a reactive side which recorded painful experiences, and those painful experiences held you back in life today. Well, that may sound fine, but after being out, I've realized that there are a lot of things that L. Ron Hubbard used that were other people's philosophies and then tweaked them to make them his own. So Buddhism, for example. The problem is that they have a different way of getting to those painful emotions, and it's something called auditing, which is done with an e-meter, which is like a lie detector, and you sit there and hold these cans that have a tiny amount of electricity that runs through them, and you are asked questions by somebody called an auditor. So that person is supposed to be listening and guiding you. The problem is they don't guide you to the areas that you truly want to talk about. So if you've had a bad day with a spouse and you want to talk about that, they're going to guide you to the areas that make you feel the worst. Well, what did you do to create that? And so what happens is you start to realize as a Scientologist that if any horrible things happen to you or any horrible illnesses such as cancer, you are led to believe that you created them all. If a child is molested, they created it. If a woman is raped or a man, they created it. If you get cancer, you pulled it in. And it is a horrible feeling to feel that every single accident or ailment or situation that happens to you is always your fault.
But if these sessions make every member of the Church of Scientology feel humiliated and worthless, why would anybody stay in the organization?
Because they build you back up, right? If you look at any sort of brainwashing or cult, they break you down and build you back up. So in session, you get broken down. And the only way you get out of session is you have this realization that it's all me. I created it. It's my fault. And I'm going to fix myself. I'm going to make myself a better person. And the church has courses to help you become a better person, so they say. And so now it becomes coming out of session and taking these courses and relearning how to think. And then everybody is cheering you on and so proud of you that you took full responsibility and so proud of you that you are learning a new way.
And those courses come with a pretty stiff tuition.
They do. They start out small in the beginning to lure people in. And then once you have done the basic courses, they are thousands, if not tens of thousands of dollars. And to go all the way up to the highest level is hundreds and thousands of dollars.
Mm-hmm. So you lived well and you gave a lot to the church, but then you discovered that you had fallen in love with another woman.
Yes.
And that became a problem for the church. How did they find out?
So this is interesting. I tried to come out, and I talk about this a lot in the book, of what happened to me when I tried to come out at 19, and the church was not having it. So it was something that I had to push down and lock away, which was very, very difficult for me. So once I finally divorced, I had tried to divorce 5 times. And once one abusive night was just more than I was willing to take, I told the church that.
And to make it clear, you were trying to get divorced through the church, right? I mean, you could have gotten a civil divorce anytime.
That's right. And I was trying to, and that's what happens. The church requires that you do everything through the church. If you do anything outside of the church, you have to go through something called the International Justice Chief of the Church of Scientology and get approved. And that means going to the police, suing for divorce, or suing another church member. So in my case, I ended up finally leaving in 2008 and divorcing. And I was introduced to a woman, and she was a lesbian and had been out for many years. And we eventually fell in love over the course of about a year, year and a half. And it just absolutely shattered my entire belief system. You have to realize in Dianetics, L. Ron Hubbard thinks that gay people are the lowest of the low. And he quotes in Science of Survival that we should be disposed of quietly and without sorrow. So their narrative that they're speaking right now to say that we have no stance on relationships and no stance on homosexuality is an absolute lie, because all you have to do is read the church's scripture. So the moment that I said, I am no longer donating and I am no longer going to be part of an organization who will not let me love the person that I love, then they have something called fair game. And it is a policy that L. Ron Hubbard wrote that if somebody defects from the church, Scientologists may lie, harass, and harm another Scientologist or person who speaks out against the Church of Scientology. And it is a policy written by L. Ron Hubbard and applied today.
Michelle LeClaire is the author of Escaping Scientology and Fighting for the Woman I Love. The whole interview is on the Ross Files podcast.